try and keep your questions and contributions brief. The reason why I ask you to do that is it means you get through more people, and if one can always come back to you later on. So do try and keep them brief. I know some of you won't, but do try and do that, please.
I should be a model of brevity. I just want to make a contribute my favourite fact to illustrate what you've been saying. But at the end of the First World War, there were 21,000 new millionaires in the United States. 21,000 new millionaires as a result of the economics of that war. 21,000.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, I think we could answer Richard Hennicar's statement that in Germany after the First World War there were 21,000 extra billionaires. But the point I wanted to make is that given, for example, that fascist Italy, and this was one of the targets that was seen by the Allies as a good thing to invade for democracy or whatever, given that fascism was precisely about the failure of the working class, the failure of syndicalist movements, and thus the rise of Mussolini, doesn't this show us that there's absolutely no point going to war for democracy, because we're looking at it from the angle of class struggle. If workers were sufficiently powerful to get democracy for themselves in a country, they would have done it already. What we will do by attacking a country is actually make it more of a dictatorship even after it falls, and that's what's happened, for example, to Iraq.
Yes, the part of the statement on war does deal with the rise of fascism and the Socialist Party's own case that fascism basically arose in those countries because of the political lack of understanding of the working class and their support for democracy and the failure of democracy for the working class in those areas. That was one of the contributing factors of the rise of fascism, precisely because of obviously of the key position of the working class and its understanding in politics. But also, I mean, even further, when it was the workers that actually deposed Mussolini and strung him up from a lamppost, it was American forces that helped put down the workers' revolts in northern Italy and helped restore liberal democracy and a favourable capitalist government to Italy. So yes, I mean, they had no interest in democracy as such, and we can clearly see that. And I mean, the fact that Italy has spent the next 50 years in a form of turmoil over its politics precisely because of that, I think illustrates the case that it's the working class's understanding that's all key. And what I didn't say at the end of my talk, which I had planned, which is obviously our unique position on war, that it's about working class understanding achieving socialism through peaceful democratic means, which means we reject war as such. It means that we are pretty much the only organisation on the side of civilisation in the world at the moment. You know, we're the only ones who are actually standing up for civilisation, whereas pretty much everyone else is standing up for barbarism when they say that they believe in war. We say, well, look, war's never going to achieve anything useful for us. We only through coming together and realising we have enough strength without fighting that sort of war, in the class war, which rests on our shoulders and on our strength and our understanding. That means that we're the only ones who have a consistent anti-war position, I think.
I mean, I've read the same stuff you were talking about, the argument at the beginning of the Second World War, in connection with, there was a founder member called Jackham, who took the position that the party ought to support the war, because he said that the Declaration of Principles was premised on the existence of political democracy. So we didn't have political democracy, the Declaration of Principles didn't apply. Well, in fact, he ended up getting expelled. But in the argument, I thought you made one valid point. That statement says war cannot be defended, democracy cannot be defended by war. And he said it can. And in fact, the outcome of the Second World War did restore democracy. I mean, forget about countries like France, Italy, and so on. Countries like Holland, and Norway, and Denmark, which had more or less sort of the same sort of political regime before the war as Britain, it was restored by war. I mean, that wasn't the purpose of the war. So I think what that statement should have said, and it's what Simon has said, not that democracy cannot be defended by war, but that democracy should not be defended by war. Now that is a different statement, but I mean, I think that is one that can be defended much more easily because, as a matter of fact, democracy can be defended by war. I mean, so I think the argument, that was one point up to Jackham, but I'm not saying that means that therefore, because democracy can be defended by war, we should try to defend it by war. But I mean, if you make a statement like that, you have to back it up. It's better to say democracy should not be defended by war because it involves, you know, killing and slaughtering fellow workers and so on. That's not worth it.
Well, on the point of what happened to Holland, Denmark, et al., what I'd say, I mean, they weren't directly, although they were invaded, they were fairly incidental to the main thrust of the war. And what happened to them was that the Nazis in Germany imposed a friendly government in order to be able to have its hegemony over Europe, and it wanted friendly governments. Now, what happened afterwards is, because of great power politics, even though you might have elected governments, these countries would probably still have ended up akin to Germany as they are now to America, which is they would have had to follow the political trends, and they would have had to kowtow to Germany in much the same way. And probably even had the working class managed to restore democracy in those countries on their own bat, they probably would have still found that the freedom for manoeuvre would have been released. But as it was, because the Nazi occupying forces were driven out, that sort of tendency for the working class to liberate itself was obviated. Obviously, they had democracy crushed by main force, and that main force was removed. So I'm not absolutely certain myself whether or not. I still tend to think that democracy can't be defended by force, except when situations where it's being forcibly suppressed at the time being. But that's obviously a point that's still up for debate. I mean, I think that a lot of these statements that I have before, there's still a lot of room for debate, as the fact that there's still been debate to this day about whether or not the party was right on the Second World War, or whether or not the particular issues within these statements are correct. Obviously, and part of what I was trying to get at is that the party isn't a monolith, and its position on war is not a moralistic one, and it's not a simply unthinking one. It's a one that's been arrived at through a great deal of debate and argument within the party, and through democratic decision making. I think that's an important point to emphasise.
I'm just interested in hearing that you've been very clear about what you're not, what you don't support, which is capitalist wars. But then what I'm wondering is that in the class war, which is obviously our concern in terms of, I mean, the implication for that is a need to provide the workers with power, for instance, to resist, which also implies force in some sense, in some kind of context. I'm just wondering what can this party do in these kind of circumstances of capitalist society to promote class war, you know, workers' power, real workers' power? Would that not involve some kind of force at some point, you know, which is force of will, I suppose, as well?
Yeah. Well, we say force of understanding.
Resisting propaganda, for instance.
Well, exactly. We've always been very clear that the key factor in the class struggle is the understanding of the workers of their own condition, and of the need for socialism, and in the need for a solid majority of workers to be behind whatever decision. So, because the working class and whatever it decides is basically the socially determined class. Because if you think about it, capitalists are a tiny minority. For the most part, they don't actually actively intervene in the economy anymore. They live through the mere ownership of property and leave the running of their firms to workers who are, albeit highly paid and very loyal, who are still workers, and they leave the workers run the entire economy. Now, this is a massive, integrated, incredibly complex economy, which can only keep going with the goodwill of the workers, with the ongoing consent. And if capitalists start to resist us, we can always resist back simply at the first instance by withdrawing our consent and withdrawing our cooperation with this, and by actively fighting them on the political front to take control of the machinery of state power. Now, because the capitalist class cannot physically manage the state themselves, they've had to set up, or they've and had forced on them by the workers who want to share in the state, political democracy. So the positions of power in the state are now up for competition through political democracy, which the workers can take control of through the ballot box, we say, primarily, and then therefore can use against the capitalist class to prevent them using any military response. Because once you take away the control of the army, they've got no force to resist us with. That's basically what our statement on violence is. So the working class resists first and foremost through understanding, and secondly through organising itself, organise, educate, agitate, you know, it's the old Holy Trinity. Once we take control of political power, there's not a lot the capitalists are going to be able to do about it. So we tell workers, look, you have to understand first off you're a worker, second off that the state is there to keep you down, it's not your state, you have no interest in it. The only way you can organise now is to come together as a vast majority, peacefully, democratically, try and preserve as much as productive force. We'll need every single factory, every single worker. Every worker that's lost in a war is a worker lost to socialism, because we need every pair of hands we can get to make a world fit to live in. Another reason to oppose it. And so that's our main effort, is focused on the understanding of the workers. Because once the workers make their mind up, there's not a lot of force going to be able to change it. As seen in this anti-war march on the weekend, I've been on plenty of demos where we've been outnumbered by the police. Because they think it's going to be future troublemakers, they'll send 6,000 police along and they'll surround you. Now, there would have been nothing the police could have done had 1.5 million people decided to do something a bit more than march. And so, I mean, our rulers are aware of how fragile their rule is. And it's mostly, as we said in Spain, it was a great chunk of the workers were supporting either the fascists, the Liberal Democratic Party, capitalist parties, or simply, you know, they were fighting among each other because they didn't have a clear, concise understanding of the route of march, which is what the Socialist Party exists to provide, that sort of clear scientific understanding.
Yes, sir, back.
Yeah, I'd like to ask, you've touched on what I wanted to ask, really, but I mean, I've always considered that the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the ordinary soldier, sailor, policeman, is a working unit, not on that basis. When a war breaks out, I mean, there always was, but say in the country which we're in, Britain, if there was a war and there was conscription was introduced, do you think that the party's position should be that we'd actively stop people from joining, we'd agitate to stop people to draft dodging? That's what we mean, will we promote the dodging of the draft and harbour conscientious objectors who may not be socialists? Is it a way of trying to bring people over to socialist ideas?
Right, well, I'll deal with the last point first, which I think that as we put such a key focus on understanding, the sort of opportunism of trying to bring people in through providing a service like helping them out of the draft is not going to help spread socialist ideas any more than arguing with them in the pub would. So I think that we wouldn't certainly adopt that sort of idea as a tactic. This isn't a theoretical question. This one can be answered historically. In two instances, the party did oppose the draft in World War I, but it basically said that its members were on their own. And likewise in World War II, the members were basically on their own. And they refused to join in with conscientious objection leagues and the like, precisely because the party exists only to fight for socialism. But obviously, I mean, resisting the draft and resisting going to war obviously is a part of the whole idea of what the party's about. And clearly, as they argued at the time, if there were sufficient numbers of workers with sufficient socialist understanding who were resisting the war, then the war wouldn't happen anyway, and you know, we'd be able to fight back. But as it was, the party always took the view during wars that, you know, that we're so small, the state's so powerful, it's better to duck and run rather than risk the retribution of the state coming down your head. And that's historically what the party did. Was it's a joy to read the issues of the Socialist Standard from the Second World War, which have very, very long, lengthy and boring articles about ancient Greece in them.
You do understand the Peloponnesian War.
Yes,
poetry.
Yes, there's all sorts of stuff about ancient wars, Your Honour. But the party never flatly flouted that sort of thing, because it's important to keep the socialist organisation intact. And when but members have helped other members, you know, in their conscientious objection cases. I've seen the sheets that are up in the party archive.
Frank, did you want to
A question of the party's attitude to war. I think you could say that the most vehement defenders of the orthodox position, particularly on the Second World War, accepted without question, without any doubt whatsoever, and I'm not saying it should be a change, but those who actually take the most ultra-orthodox view rationalise this in one sense by minimising the importance of political democracy, bourgeois democracy. It's all a bit of a myth, democracy, it's all a facade. There's hardly any difference between Nazi Germany and, capitalist Britain in the 30s and 40s. Anyway, when the war started, what a democracy there was, and it was worthless anyway, it was curtailed. So this is often rationalised. And I heard it just a week or so ago at another meeting, taking this attitude. The question of the Jewish question. Robert touched on the Intifada, the Israel. I'm being serious but facetious. that if the Nazis hadn't been rudely interrupted in their programme of annihilating the whole of European Jewry, they had an estimated target of 11. They sadly, they only got halfway, 6 million, 5 or 6 million. If they succeeded, maybe the state of Israel wouldn't have been established, because the European Jews wouldn't have any European Jews to go there. On the question of war, the party's been a little bit disingenuous, and still is, because the information which Bill's come across, I didn't know existed. I know there was a controversy within the party in the Spanish Civil War. I knew that in the Second World War, there's one or two members actually joined the armed forces voluntarily. Whether it was because they were opposed, supported the war, maybe they decided they'll join before they're called up. But I didn't know the prolonged discussion which had taken place within the party, you know, branches and resolutions and counter statements. I didn't know that, and the party's a bit disingenuous when they produced documents, Socialist Party of War, in the articles in the Standard now, referring to what the 14, 18, 39 position. They don't mention this, do they? There's never been any mention. I guarantee there's plenty of members here who wouldn't have been even known, and I'm one of the oldest members here, they wouldn't have even known of this prolonged discussion in the party in 1939. That would, as news to me, certainly the magnitude of it, and therefore we're a little bit dishonest, not completely telling the whole truth, are we? When we imply, just briefly finish this. The Socialist Party position on war, referring to the 39 statement, said there didn't have to be a discussion in the party. The party knew the position, the EC just produced the statement. But it wasn't quite as simple as that after all, was it? There was all this argy-bargy within the party. So let's be open and above board on these issues.
Well,
yes, well, on the last point first, yes, that was what the talk today was about. It was about, clearly, it's a long time ago, it does take someone going up into the archives and rooting through all these documents, which aren't there, and only sardonically retentive people will probably do that sort of thing. So that's why I did it, and because I was interested, and I was pretty sure I had heard some places.
Sardonically retentive.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I had heard that there had been some dissension in the party, and I thought, well, there must be something in the records. And so it was worth going out there and finding out what dissension is. And I think it's to the party's credit that there was dissension, because obviously we're a democratic organisation, and socialist understanding can only be advanced through thoroughgoing debate. On the question of the Jewish matter, on the Holocaust, I mean, the party's position during the war, I can answer historically, there was the question about the oppression of the Jews in Germany. And the party answered that there was racism going on all over the world by various different powers in their colonies and in their imperial world. And it was no different from, say, the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, who died in famine in India that was brought about because of the war. And of course, I would reject utterly any idea of corpse counting and trying to say, well, which outcome would have been best, 11 million Jews or 20 million Russians plus however many of every other nationality that fought and died in the war. I don't think that fighting to stop the Holocaust, well, no one knew. I mean, the British government didn't even tell people about it. You know, they kept their knowledge of it secret. The Catholic Church colluded in it. And as for democracy as a facade, I would certainly refute or reject rather that position. Democracy is not a facade, and it's very vital for the socialist understanding. But also, as we said earlier, the important point about democracy is not the physical presence of a ballot and the formal existence of it. It's about the fact that the workers understand democracy, want democracy, and have fought for it and obtained it for themselves. And of course, the fact that in these countries the workers were supporting dictatorships means that there was pretty much no way, unless you're going to go on and impose some form of formal democracy, which would then be fought over, which is what happened, that you'd have had much of an advance. And they left, you know, two fascist dictatorships entirely intact. So I think we can discount any idea that it was a war for democracy.
Let me take Bob first, then Simon, because you've already spoken, Simon. I'll take Bob then. Yeah, you're done, but you've already spoken, or well, you've not spoken.
One second.
Well, okay, I'll take you. It's Bob, then I'll take this gentleman next, then Simon then. Okay.
All right, cheers, Ken. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll really sort of back up at least the second bit of what Bill has just said. I'm glad he's brought to the day school's attention the statement on violence in the 70s. Maybe in connection with fascism as well, you would say that you defend SPGB meetings against people trying to break them up, such as fascist groups or whatever. So, I mean, I'd see, you know, they're, and in fact, from what I understand, talking to certain members, that has gone on in the past. Actually against members of the Communist Party of Great Britain as well during the Second World War. Maybe that therein lies something else. I just also want to say about this issue about workers in uniform, which I think is connected to this. You know, yes, you know, members of the armed forces, particularly when they're in a professional one, the conscript army, members of the police force, yes, they are workers in uniform in a technical, sociological sense. You know, but at the end of the day, they've got to come down on the side of the uniform or the worker, basically. If they want to come over and join our side of the class struggle, great. If they don't, as far as I'm concerned, they're in the way. They're getting out of the way one way or the other.
Right. Well, I'll deal with the first... I keep doing in reverse order, because that's the thing I remember the most. Your last point, I'd say that the way that we intend to get them out of the way is that we'll be on all the police committees, we'll be the ones giving them the orders, and that they won't be in the way any longer because we've democratically taken control of the machinery of state.
That's a little bit naive, isn't it? I mean, particularly when you're dealing like with events such as what happened in the Spanish Civil War, where you've got, you know, the reactionary part of the ruling class has decided that it's going to reverse that settlement by force. Yeah, what are you going to? Do you really believe that, you know, the SAS or the parachute regiment are going to stand down just because you know, you've been elected as the Speaker of the House of Commons and you say so, Bill? Do you really think the Queen is going to sign the legislation that abolishes private property? I don't think so, mate. I think this will have to be defended in the course of social recognition.
Well, obviously, I mean, like I say, the point I made is that we'll be in charge of the actual machinery of administrating and controlling the armed forces, and the physical means of coordinating, as well as a fairly sized chunk, I'd imagine, of said armed forces who would come over our side or would volunteer on the grounds that they're going to be fighting and defending socialism. And as the statement of violence says, we don't believe that they would go up against a considered, thoroughgoing and unified majority against them. And if they did, they wouldn't last very long. And that's what control of the state means. It means, first and foremost, removing control of the state from reactionary elements that can't be used against us. And ultimately, if need be, we'll be prepared to use whatever forces available from the state and such parts of it as we can take over to our own use to suppress any recalcitrant minorities, I believe is the usual term, with as minimum force as possible, obviously. Now, to come back to your first point, yes, we do. We're not pacifists. I mean, I think if I didn't read that out, but the party statement says we're not pacifists. It's not a moral objection to violence. It's a political and sociological objection to war. And I'd say that defending a meeting with violence, and indeed, you know, fighting on the picket line and some elements, you know, of violence on street politics, is qualitatively different from organised modern warfare. I think that's what the party was partly drawing out, and it does actually draw it out, I think, in one of the statements, that there's this qualitative difference between modern total war and a brawl on the street. And what we're against is modern total war. We're not pacifists, we'll defend our means and we'll defend ourselves. But on the same token, the party's never going to set up its own militia and, you know, and going for pistolismo or anything like that. We have a political solution, or political road to socialism, and we think that we can use that to have a violent settlement to the class war. A violent, peaceful settlement to the class war.
Well, Sam, you've been for a while, so I'll take Simon next, and I'll take you.
Right. Just two things. Two quick things. Number one, regarding the whole Jewish question, as I tried to bring out in my talk, let's disconnect this whole business of Zionism and the Holocaust. Okay? Zionism, as an idea, started off in 1897 with Jan Breitzman, whatever his name is. Yeah? It was picked up by the British state to use as a tool during the 20s and 30s. It has nothing to do with the death of Jews during fascist Germany that settlement of Palestine was encouraged. Okay? And the best way to look at this is that the Americans who would claim this, okay, the Americans have slaughtered the equivalent number of Indians, and Native Americans currently probably have about 10 square miles of dirt somewhere in Michigan. Okay, so if you're thinking about what the Jews have just for being Jews, as far as American compassion is concerned, the Jews should have about 10 square miles of Palestine. Okay. The second matter is that we have to always think about conflict and violence in terms of the class struggle. And this week, Yeah? This week, in Bolivia, there's been a battle between the police and the army because the police went on strike. Now, I'm not going to cry about dead Bolivian coppers, okay? I'm sorry. Yeah, okay, their workers, whatever, you've seen what Bolivian coppers do to Bolivian workers, okay? But at the same time, what this demonstrates is that there are splits in the violence deployed by the state, and that workers, even in uniform, are at the end of the day workers, okay? So we do need to look beyond our own fear of the state's violence and look at the state, look at the capitalist fear of state violence and how they actually control people who are basically workers rather than capitalists. Yeah.
No disagreement with your second point. Yeah, I've heard about the stuff in Bolivia, and it is interesting. But it seems that the whole of South America is falling apart at the moment. With regards to Daniels, I think it's important to emphasise first and foremost that anti-Semites have got a very strong reason for supporting Zionism, in that they want the Jews to go to their own country and get out of this, whatever country they live in. You know, there's quite a long history of anti-Semitic Zionists in the grounds of go and get out, and go to your own country. And also, I mean, part of what you're saying about this whole business of state building, I mean, one of the contributory reasons I would suggest for the Holocaust very much was that there was two great diasporas in Middle Europa. One was the Germans, one was the Jews. Now, a German empire was trying to be built. They were going to divide it into lots of little nation states. There was only one other group of people who spread across the whole thing. And like you say, when that happens, people do tend to get slaughtered. And so I would say, I mean, our answer to, you know, the Holocaust or the issues around it is, it's that it's nationalism and it's state building and it's the concept of property that promotes this sort of genocide and has done it again and again and again. And so that's why the proper rational answer is to fight for a world commonwealth where it doesn't matter who you are or where you live, you're part of one human race that controls the world together. And that's the most appropriate and the most humane response to come out of something that no one could have stopped at the time, and you know, we only know about afterwards, really.
Right, just going to be this gentleman next, and that'll be Richard, Danny, this gentleman, just in the young order, okay, because I'm writing down as he put their hands up. You may not see his put their hand up, so just let you know. So it'll be you next.
With regard to Frank's contribution and your very intriguing reference to party members who went to Spain, I was present at Jackham's statement in that conference. I can't remember what year it was, 42, I think it was. Of course, at the time, I didn't realise the significance of what he was saying, nor did I realise the significance of what was going on in, perhaps I was too young, in Spain. But I can see now the dilemma of those members that you mentioned who went to Spain. I can understand their dilemma. And I would ask you to think in terms of what the Hitlerite, the logic of the Hitlerite regime, irrespective of its dictatorial and fascist and Nazi nature, but its manic racist idea and what it led to. We all know what it led to, and I don't think anybody can ignore this now. Now, I'm thinking myself at the time, had I been, it's a purely hypothetical question in my mind, but had I been fully and totally and completely aware of the logic of the Hitlerite regime and what they were going to embark upon, would I not have been in a dilemma as to what to do? And another thing, just one brief, simple question to everyone in this room. Isn't everyone here pleased that the conclusion of the war resulted in the end of the Hitlerite regime?
Right, absolutely. I would say that. Absolutely everyone would be pleased to see that particular fascist regime ended. And we'd be even more pleased to see all the other fascist regimes right throughout Europe put a stop to as well. However, we have to accept, as a basically historical fact, if the party is writing its observations of how the world works, that the ending of the Hitlerite regime was not necessarily the end of the war. It was not the aim of the war. And in fact, the fact that various, you know, the Catholic Church helped a rather large number of Nazis escape to South America, and the fact that the Americans took on a rather large number of very helpful scientists, kept a lot of people who were in the regime still were part of the government. You know, I was just a civil servant, Your Honour, and this sort of thing. That has to be balanced off against that. So as to your first point about if you knew what Hitlerism was going to do, I mean, I wasn't addressing this as a moral case. I mean, from the political, social, scientific argument of the Socialist Party, the case, as I said, was between how do we support the class in action and how do we promote the cause of socialism. Now, an individual member may well find it very difficult. I mean, the party found it difficult to reconcile support for purely socialist action against the realities of that sort of political that sort of fascism on the ground. And it found a resolution in this: individual members have their own choice, the party has a job to do this sort of thing, and to look the other way. Now, that might be a bit of a look, don't tell sort of policy and a fudge, but it was one fairly rational response. And I think the ultimate response that they came up with later, which is that war is not going to provoke democracy, as such, I think that is a more theoretically thoroughgoing answer. And obviously, I mean, if you look at what it led to, it led to American police operations and various other imperialist operations that led to the deaths of thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps not on the scale or the particular brutal efficiency of the coordination of the death camps, but it still led to a world in which wars continue to exist. And so I think that the ultimate socialist party case, that our best bet lies in the fight for socialism at all times, and especially in the case of war, I think remains fairly solid. And it's not a choice I'd want to make myself. I'll put it that way. Yeah, it'd be a real test, you know. But it's still a test. I think that, you know, I was given a history of the party's ideas.
A gentleman came up. Bill was quite right to say it's the credit of the party, but there is ongoing debate about these attitudes, and I'm probably in the minority in the party with my own view, but we do exist. I get shivers down my spine every time I hear someone talk about defending socialism. To me, the concept of a global change of consciousness at the level that we require to change society, then having some violent uprising against it, when that change had already taken place voluntarily, seems to me inconceivable. And as a corollary to that, if it did happen, and we did have to defend socialism, I believe it would be a tragedy that would have greater consequences than many of us envisage. For we know that once you take to violence to defend violence, even if you succeed, do you then have to maintain violence to keep that uprising down? Do you then have to have socialist armies and socialist police to ensure that the status quo remains? But I think these are very important questions we have to keep in mind all the time. And I also, lastly, just want to make it clear that if there was such a circumstance, which I can't envisage, as a pacifist, I cannot honestly say whether I would or would not fight if I saw tanks coming towards my children. I do not know. That is the honest position for a pacifist to take. But as someone who has a philosophical and ethical attitude of non-violence, I want to make it clear to everybody who are visitors here that if I took that attitude at the time when the rest of you were defending socialism, I would not be expelled from the party.
I absolutely agree that if we had the understanding of the working class, that I too think that it's an important part of our case that I think we have got the answer to the violent objectors in the terms of mass socialist understanding and solidarity. And I think that is our greatest strength and one of our greatest credits, that we do have this idea of peaceful root socialism. I think fundamentally where I deviate from a lot of Trotskyists and leftists who say, of course we don't want violence, but, and then they immediately say we're preparing our retaliation. But they're going to get their retaliation in first. They basically have established in their own minds that the only way forward is through violence. Now, I'd say that the only question arises is if the state tries to intervene at a point in which the party or the socialist movement is not ready or prepared to defend itself before it's the majority. But as I said to a former comrade when he asked me the question at a previous meeting, there's this crunch line for the state. If it intervenes too soon, it'll squash a gnat, and, you know, the gnat will grow again into something big. Or if it's too late, that's it, it won't be able to do it. You know, once we get to a certain size, 1,000 or 2,000 members even, it would just be too difficult for the state to maintain itself as a highly intricate, interconnected organisation that requires political democracy to function. They will not be able to stop us. I think fundamentally that's where it comes in. From there on in, I think that we have the answer to the violent force being used against us in that context.
Yeah, I mean, I'm horrified that I agree with Richard here. you see, the thing is,
still at last,
yeah, I'm getting old. No, you see, the state requires its continuance on legitimacy, and that it gets at election times, and it's
And it's in a bit of a state now because it's not getting that mass vote. I mean, the vote is falling all the time. So you could say that it's a crisis of legitimacy for the state, but it depends on it. Now, if you've got an organisation that's, you know, fully democratic, that's fully open and fully honest, and the state starts to attack it, then the state, therefore, is, you know, if this organisation gets big enough where it becomes a threat and the state attacks it, then in the eyes of the working class, the state itself will start to lose legitimacy. And this is one of the things that really sort of like sold the party to me. I mean, if the party was for sale, which it isn't, but this is one of the things one of the reasons I got into the party. Because the thing is the state is buggered if it does and buggered if it doesn't. So, I mean, the strategy of the party, the tactics of the party are absolutely sound in as far as it should be open, democratic, honest, you know, put forward its case. And when the case takes off, if the state attacks, then the state then loses more legitimacy. And if it doesn't, well, then the legitimacy just disappears.
Yes.
Christ, I mean,
I don't know whether it's a slip of the tongue when Bill said Socialist Party members volunteered for the armed forces. I think it was much more the case was they didn't resist the call-up. They didn't take a principled stand of conscientious objection to joining the armed forces on political grounds. Certainly there were members of the party who said, no, I can't, for various reasons, take the conscientious stand against the Second World War and did in fact serve in the armed forces, some of them spending their time doing what socialists do in trying to spread socialist ideas. And to take Max's point, yes, you know, who cannot have sympathy for that position? I mean, there were party members who were Jewish and who had experienced persecution for being Jewish, who nevertheless didn't fight in the Second World War. And as to Frank's ignorance of the debates that you discovered in the archive, it comes as a little surprise to me. I was aware of these debates as to what the party position should be in the 39-45 war long before I went and had a dive in the archives and turned up these very interesting party debates. And as to the problem of the Holocaust and Hitler's Jewish policies, I mean, the whole thing is still very problematic. It's still the subject of intense historical debate as to whether the Nazi policy had from the very beginning been the extermination of the Jews of Europe, or whether it was something that happened opportunistically following the Operation Barbarossa, when Germany invaded Russia and found on its hands increasing number of Jews who they had said would never be part of Germany. So, you know, had the party been aware of all the facts, which it wasn't, it's not clear to me at all what the party position would have been.
I think you've covered a lot of ground covered already in the debate there. I think, just to say, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of ground to be had in terms of, if we think about this as a debate for clarifying socialist ideas, in the abstract, what would we have done if? I don't think there's a lot of use in that, because particularly we wouldn't know what we would have done. And we don't know, particularly, it's more important, what would the party members at the time have done, and what would they have said? Well, Max is one of them, so, you know, he can speak for himself, at least, you know, I'm a bit too young to have been there, mercifully, I think.